Now this evening, the speaker who is going to address us is Mr. E. Harvey, who is going to lecture us on Marxist monetary theory. From what I gather, I understand that Mr. Hardy is a member of the Socialist Party of Great Britain, that he has been in the socialist movement for many years. He's spoken and he's debated and he's made numerous contributions on Marxian theory. As I understand, an active trade unionist. In fact, if my knowledge is correct, I understand that he graduated from the school in economics, from the economics department, I won't say recently, but some years ago. But however, the way we intend to plan this meeting is that Mr. Hardy is going to speak for about 50 minutes, after which time the meeting will be thrown open so that we can participate, we can ask questions and make contributions to discussion. I'm sure what he's going to say, a lot of what he's going to say, is going to be controversial. From my readings of Marxian economics, the framework that they employ is totally different from the framework that is used by conventional economic theory and economic analysis. I would point out one thing, however. This is not a forum on behalf of any organisation. We've not invited Mr. Hardy to come along and use this opportunity to make party political points. And I would appreciate if anyone does desire to participate in discussion, they're not going to use it as an opportunity to champion the cause of the IS or the IMG or any other group at all. It's strictly a meeting on Marxist theory, on how a Marxist looks at economics and the monetary system. So without further ado, I'll call upon Mr. Hardy to address us. As I say, I'll speak for about 45 or 50 minutes, and then the meeting will be ours to participate, to ask questions and discussion. So I'll call upon Mr. Hardy to make his contribution.
Well, the chairman has explained the scope of this meeting, and I'll endeavour to stick to the lines laid down. If not, presumably the chairman will tell me. There is a very great deal of interest in Marx today, but you will notice, it's my view, and I don't think anyone would disagree with it, that the interest in Marx today is not in Marx in economics. It's in Marx, the philosopher, the writer on social evolution, on alienation and things like that, but not on economics. Well, it was very different 40 or so years ago. I'm quite sure, somebody may contradict me on this, that when I was at the London School of Economics, there were more people who knew about Marx, not necessarily agreed with him, but took an interest in it, either to support or oppose then, than there are now. And of course, there is a reason for this. The reason broadly is that interest in Marx was swept aside by the rise to popularity and fame of the economist Maynard Keynes. Keynes came along between the wars and said that capitalism could be saved by doing certain things that he specified, and that you could get full employment and things like this. And for very good reasons, those people who had previously been interested in Marx in a sympathetic way, particularly the trade unions, had their course changed. They swept over to Keynesian economics, and this is completely true of the trade union movement. To the extent that they have any economic basis at all, it is Keynesian economics. Now, earlier, this was not true. In the latter part of the 19th century, and during the Depression years between the wars, there had been a growing interest in Marx, particularly in the trade union movement. Now, as Keynes was the man who replaced Marx, it's interesting, and I particularly want to draw your attention to the fact that Keynes had a very poor opinion of Marx. I quote Keynes on Marx's Capital, an obsolete economic textbook which I know to be not only scientifically erroneous, but without interest or application for the modern world. That's in a thing written by Keynes called A Short View of Russia, published in 1925. Now I want to give you a second reference to Marx made by Keynes, because it has some particular bearing on the present situation. Keynes preferred Silvio Gazzale to Marx. He wrote in The General Theory, I believe that the future will learn more from the spirit of Gesell than from that of Marx. Now, Gesell was particularly interested in monetary theory and interest rates, and Keynes had a natural affinity and sympathy with Gesell. And I shall come back to this later and show that it has a particular significance in relation to Marx. But anyway, you've got at this point, Keynes is saying Marx is no good, Marx is not scientific, Gesell is scientific, and you should pay more interest in Gesell. Well, time has had its revenges. 20-30 years ago, hardly anybody opposed Keynes and Keynesian ideas. Well, as you all of you know, this is changing. A lot of the Keynesians and neo-Keynesians no longer have the confidence that they used to have. And I'll just take one particular example. A letter was written to the Times on the 26th of February this year by Professor Neild of Cambridge. Professor Little of Oxford, a bit of inter-university conflict, had accused Neild of being an orthodox Keynesian, and Neild replied, "I and a number of my colleagues at Cambridge believe that the orthodox view to which many of us used to subscribe is wrong, and its application in policy making has been a major cause of Britain's post-war economic troubles." Well, here you see is a pretty big confession to make from people who had been Keynesians, and as I shall endeavour to show later on, it's an additional reason why you should at least know what Marx had to say about these problems. What we would say, I mean, I speak as a Marxist, I think that Marx's economics are indispensable if you want to understand how the capitalist world works, but the capitalism we now have, supposed to have been saved and remodeled by the Keynesians, looks very much like the capitalism that Marx wrote about in the 19th century, particularly, of course, in his major works, Capital. And not least, I would say that Marx's views on monetary theory have a particular application to the situation that you find at the present time. Now, you have a lecture described as about monetary theory, one ought, I suppose, to attempt the boundaries of monetary theory, and it's rather difficult. For example, if you were to read the stuff written by Milton Friedman, a monetarist, or by Walters of the London School of Economics, you will find that in treating of monetary theory, they inevitably find themselves dealing with somewhat wider aspects, and equally inevitably, this is true of Marx in economics. But in particular, you have to notice about Marx's economic system that you cannot pick out of it part of it and say, this is the monetary department, we can treat this on its own. Marx, above all economists, his views on monetary problems derive completely and necessarily from Marx's economic system as a whole. But just one other word of introduction, so to speak, about Marx. You have to remember that Marx set out to study the economic laws of capitalism. He wasn't seeking to lay down universal laws. He carefully prescribed what he was dealing with. You'll find it right at the beginning of the first volume of Capital. Secondly, Marx was not offering to tell governments how to run the system and how to achieve certain results, such as full employment, something of course that Marx, of course, would have believed to be impossible. Now, as I say, you can only understand Marx's views on monetary problems by going to what is essential in the whole Marxist system, and that is Marx's labour theory of value. Obviously, within the time available, I couldn't hope to do more in the main than just tell you what it is. No doubt something else may happen in questions and discussion afterwards, but for the time being, what I'm mainly doing is telling you what Marx did say and what he didn't say, rather than going into the kind of detail that you would have to go into if you were trying to demonstrate that it's correct. I merely say that I think that the Marxian view is the correct one. Now, for Marx, behind price, there is value. If, for example, a motorcycle costs more to buy than a pedal cycle, in the Marxian view, behind the price in the market, there is the value of these two articles. And Marx held that the value of an article produced in by modern industry is related to the amount of labor needed to produce that article. And he was not saying that if you looked into a particular motorcycle or pedal cycle factory and found that it took them a certain number of hours to produce that article, that narrow situation would determine its value. What Marx was saying was that at a given time and with a given general level of efficiency of industry, a number of hours of labour would be required as socially necessary to produce that article. So if you take a pedal cycle, you've got to look at the whole of the productive field of pedal cycles and say that in the given situation with the given techniques and efficiency and so on, the amount of time socially necessary to produce that bicycle is the thing that determines the value of the bicycle. The emphasis is on what is socially necessary, not what happens in a particular factory. And if, of course, conditions change, they do change. Suppose you imagine a bicycle produced 3 months ago, it's now in the market. Suppose that in that 3 months some change has taken place in the conditions of production, so that it now requires either fewer hours of labour to produce a bicycle or more hours of labour to produce a bicycle. Its value at this point in time is not the original one, but what it would be required to reproduce it now. In other words, again, the emphasis is not on the production, but on the reproduction in the sometimes changed situation. Another word of explanation about Marx's view: value is not necessarily or even often identical with price. What Marx was saying is, behind price you have got value. Value is the determining factor, but there are a number of circumstances which lead to the situation that the price deviates from the value of the article. Among these is the short-term supply and demand fluctuation. Marx would say that short changes in supply and demand in the market would put the price up or put the price down, but that, he used the phrase, he said, these supply and demand fluctuations would be about that point which he called the natural price of the article, which was related to value. Monopoly is another circumstance. Marx recognized the fact, as everybody does, that if you get a set of conditions created in which there is a monopoly of the supply of something, the person who has that monopoly or near monopoly can raise the price to a level which has no relation really with the value or with what would be the price if the monopoly didn't exist. And you've got the converse of this. You're quite familiar with what has happened in the last 40 years, more or less continuously. You've had subsidies. If a government goes into the market and buys certain commodities at the market price and then retails them at a subsidized price, you now get a price in the retail market which again is not related to value because it's below what the price would otherwise be if the government didn't provide these subsidies. Marx also pointed out that there are some commodities which sell more or less permanently above their value and some which sell permanently below their value. If I can use some modern terms instead of the ones Marx used, it would be that in the capital-intensive industries, commodities sell above their value, and in the labour-intensive industries, commodities sell below their value. But for the purpose we've got here, you don't need to worry about things like that. Another thing you want to remember about the Marxist conception, one that is very little appreciated by people, you know, haven't really looked into it, and which you can see at work wherever you see people discussing what is meant by productivity. You will find all sorts of people have gone into this business of saying, how do you measure the productivity, output per man in an industry, and the changes that take place? Well, now Marx did in fact provide something very, very useful to this that most of the others have overlooked. For Marx, the amount of labour required to produce a pedal cycle, for example, isn't just the amount of labour in the cycle factory, it's the labour required at all the stages, going back right to the very beginning, mining the ore for the metal and the rubber and everything else, all the way through the process. Or to take another example, the amount of labour socially necessary to produce one tonne of coal isn't related just to the work of miners in the coal mine. It's got to include electricians and engineers and steel workers. That is to say, the labour required to produce all the other things which are an essential part of the mining industry. You have to remember these things because, as I say, if you don't, you'll get a wrong angle on Marxian theory in general. So coming back to value, if, for example, it required an average of 50 hours socially necessary labour to produce a pedal cycle, and 400 hours, that's eight times as much, to produce a motorcycle, in the Marxist conception, the value of the motorcycle would be eight times the value of the pedal cycle. I'm now going to make a jump forward to the really getting into the monetary field, and that is money itself. And I'm going to take, as the example, gold as the money commodity. As you know, it doesn't have to be gold. It could be some other metals, and in the past it often has been gold, some other metal and some other things. But we're going to take gold as the money commodity for one very good reason, that when Marx was studying capitalism, he studied it in 19th century British conditions. And in the 19th century in Britain, gold was the accepted money commodity. It was the basis of the coinage in this country. Now, one most important thing about Marx, and here you'll find Marx strictly differentiated from a number of other people who have written on this subject, for Marx, gold functions as the money commodity only because it is itself a commodity having value. Now, there are a number of economists who have held precisely the reverse. So remember this, Marx is not saying that gold has value because it is the money commodity. He's saying precisely the reverse. He's saying only because gold is a commodity like all other commodities, is a product of labour and has a value, it's only because of this that gold could function as the money commodity. Now, because of all commodities, including gold, are values, it is possible for gold to, for all other commodities to represent their own value in gold, and through gold to represent their value and exchange with other commodities, which is of course the normal function of the money commodity. If, for example, in the 19th century it took 50 hours of socially necessary labour to produce one pedal cycle, and also 50 hours to produce 1 ounce weight of gold, the value of one pedal cycle and 1 ounce weight of gold would be the same because both of them represented 50 hours socially necessary labour. Now the next stage you go into is of course the production of coinage. In the 19th century, which Marx was studying, but I mean it's a typical example of the world in general, the modern industrialised world, the government by law did establish that the gold coin, the sovereign, the pound sterling, contained about 1/4 ounce weight of gold. So that if one pedal cycle and 1 ounce of gold both had 50 hours socially necessary labour and therefore had a similar value, and if the gold, if 1 ounce of gold was cut up into four pieces, approximately 1/4 ounce, and each one was labelled 1 sovereign, 1 pound sterling, then the price in the market corresponding to the value of the pedal cycle would be £4. See, the £4 sterling, is 1 ounce weight of gold, which contains 50 hours of labour, the pedal cycle contains 50. Here you have an exact equivalent. This is the main function, not the only function, of the monetary commodity. Now I want you to take another step forward, and I appreciate that, so to speak, that I'm going through these very, very briefly to get to the ultimate point where I want to deal with inflation. If you can imagine to yourself that in the 19th century, British capitalism had operated entirely with gold coins, sovereigns. They didn't, in fact, they had a subsidiary coins, silver and copper, which were subsidiary, I mean, they're not the main ones. They also had Bank of England notes. But if you could imagine that they had not got the notes and had not got the subsidiary coin, but had operated solely with gold coins, sovereigns, each a quarter of an ounce weight of gold, you can see that in order to carry on the buying and selling transactions at, say, 1860 in the 19th century, a certain total amount of gold would be passing from hand to hand and being held by the people who needed to hold currency. All the individuals and companies and shops who needed to hold currency, there would be a certain total mass of gold functioning in this business of enabling people to sell articles and buy articles and so on, and to hold gold coins. You might say, for example, if I take the conditions of 1938 and the price of gold in 1938, you can say that the currency in circulation, which was about £450 million, represented something over 100 million ounces of gold. So that if you had not a mixture of paper currency and coins of various kinds, but gold coins only, in the 1938 conditions, you would have had something over 100 million ounce weights of gold, 100 million ounces of gold. Now, what Marx is saying is that that total mass of gold represents a total mass of value. So you come back to our original terms, each ounce of gold is 50 hours socially necessary labour, something over 100 million ounces, you multiply it by 50, it represents this total mass of value. And the next step to recognise is, having got that picture in your mind that you could have a coinage consisting solely of gold coins of a fixed weight of gold, then you go back to the real conditions of the 19th century, where, as I say, you had a subsidiary coinage, silver and copper. You also had Bank of England notes, which were functioning just like gold coins, because, incidentally, as people used to say, a Bank of England note was as good as gold. Now, why was a Bank of England note as good as gold? And the answer is convertibility. But by law, any Bank of England note you had, you could go to the Bank of England and demand freely and immediately that the bank had give you an equivalent amount of gold at the rate fixed by law. Conversely, if you had gold, so to speak, you could go to the Bank of England and get notes for it. Now, given this state of convertibility, the value of the notes could never, except very marginally, depart from the value of the gold that it represented. And this prevented inflation from taking place, because, so to speak, the notes were always tied to a fixed weight of gold. So that at all times and in all circumstances in the 19th century, the notes were tied to gold, and there could not be inflation in the sense in which Marx used it and which economists used to use it, in the sense that inflation is depreciation of the currency. If you have this convertibility into gold at a legally fixed rate, you cannot have the currency depreciated. Now, that is the importance of convertibility. But what you have to notice about this, particularly, I've mentioned this already, that you had this convertibility in the 19th century, and therefore you could not have depreciation of the currency, and you did not have inflation. All the time from 1820 to 1914, almost a century, the price level never once rose above the level of 1820. It went down a little and up a little, always within a range of about 25%, but it never once rose above the level of 1820, all the time from 1820 to 1914. Now, this fact, which is totally ignored by a large number of the people who write about inflation, makes nonsense of a whole lot of the theories about inflation, but of course it doesn't make nonsense of Marx's theory, because this is Marx's theory. You see, if somebody comes along and offers to explain in the present inflation, as a writer recently did, as being psychological, it is due to a deep-rooted dissatisfaction with life, then you go back to the 19th century and say, well, apparently from 1820 to 1914, there was no deep-rooted dissatisfaction with life because there was no inflation. Or alternatively, if you go to the people who say inflation is due to somebody's greed, the greed of workers, or of bankers, or of retailers, or manufacturers, or shall I throw in students, you can come back and say, well, was there no greed in the 19th century? Was there no greed between 1820 and 1914? And of course it immediately shows that that kind of explanation will not explain. Now, the next thing you need to notice about this is what does convertibility and the abolition of convertibility mean in relation to inflation? First of all, Marx was saying, if you've got convertibility at a fixed and unchanging rate, you cannot have depreciation of the currency, you cannot therefore have inflation. But this does not mean that if you abolish convertibility, you necessarily have inflation. It's not the abolition of convertibility that creates the inflation, it only creates the possibility of it. Because for Marx, the inflation is the excess issue of notes. Well, of course, you see, you can abolish convertibility and still not issue an excess amount of notes. You might keep the notes at the same level as they were before. So let me now quote, read a quotation from Marx about his view of inflation. Remember what Marx was saying is, if you have convertibility, you can't have inflation. If you abolish convertibility, you may have inflation. But only because with the abolition of convertibility, you can now have an excess issue of notes. And I read from Marx, it's in Capital, Volume 1 of Capital, it's page 108 in the Allen and Unwin edition. If the paper money is in excess, if there is more of it than represents the amount of gold coins of like denomination which could actually be current, it will, apart from the danger of falling into general disrepute, represent only that quantity of gold which, in accordance with the laws of the circulation of commodities, is really required and is alone capable of being represented by paper. If the quantity of paper money issued is, for instance, double what it ought to be, then in actual fact £1 has become the money name of about 1/8 of an ounce of gold instead of about 1/4 of an ounce. The effect is the same as if an alteration had taken place in the function of gold as a standard of prices. The values previously expressed by the price £1 will now be expressed by the price £2. And I don't know whether, so to speak, you can follow that, but it is really a fairly simple conception that if you needed 100 million ounces of gold to carry on as your circulation, if you only had gold coins, if you replace them with 100 million of the equivalent of 100 million, a little bit, 400 million of pound notes, you've got no inflation because the quantities are the same. If you now double the notes, make it 800 million instead of 400 million, as Marx would say, all you're really doing is you're doubling the price level. And this is, of course, what has happened. In 1938, the currency in circulation was about 450 million pounds. It's now nearly 10 times as much. To get this into some sort of perspective, obviously many things have changed since 1938. One thing, the population has increased, production is more than double what it was in 1938, so that in any event, so to speak, you would need more currency. But working in the opposite direction has been the fact that more payments are made by cheque and fewer in currency, and the use of cheques and credit cards and so on have reduced the need for people to hold currency. And I mean, I can only state those the broad ranges of this without it being possible to go into the particular details, but you will notice that the price level now is about 6 1/4 times what it was in 1938, which is of course what Marx would have expected out of this situation. And I want to make some particular references to avoid the possibility of misunderstanding about Marx's views on inflation. Now, to start with, of course, as that is Marx's explanation of inflation, Marx repudiated the idea that trade unions can cause inflation, that wage claims can cause inflation. As Marx would say, trade unions don't print notes. As various other people have said, as Milton Friedman has said, and I think Walters of the London School of Economics has pointed this out too. And Marx dealt with this general question as to whether wages put up prices in a lecture which was printed and is still available called Value, Price and Profit. But in Value, Price and Profit, he was not dealing with inflation, he was dealing with the situation in 19th century British capitalism where there was no inflation. But Marx set out to show the wrongness of the ideas held by a man named Weston. Weston had said to Marx, look, it's no use trade unions making general wage claims and pushing up wages, because the only effect will be the prices will go up correspondingly, they will be no better off than they were before, and Marx dealt with this. I won't spend any more time on this at the moment, except to say that Marx's general argument there, I would say, is correct, and that it is still correct under inflation, but of course it is now completely masked by the fact that with currency depreciation, prices are going up in any event. Now, if it is true, as Marx said, that if you have an excess issue of inconvertible paper currency, you'll put up prices, then if you limited the note issue, you'll bring them down again. Well, Marx pointed out that in the Napoleonic War, they suspended convertibility, had an excess issue of notes, and prices went up quite sharply. They appointed the Bullion Committee to look into it. As a consequence of their report, they restored convertibility and prices came down again, which is, by the way, the reason why I chose the date 1820, when prices had come, when convertibility had been restored and prices had come down from the level of the Napoleonic War. The same thing happened in the First World War. There was an enormous excess issue of notes during the First World War, convertibility having gone. Prices leapt up. And after the First World War, they had to bring them down again, and they brought them down again. The Cunliffe Committee was appointed in 1919. It recommended that the Bank of England be instructed to limit the issue of notes. It was a somewhat complicated formula, but it meant in fact that the note issue began to come down, and prices came down with a run. They dropped about 30% in a year, and they dropped about 50% in the 10 years between 1921 and 1931. And incidentally, when you hear people saying that the rise of prices and wages now is unprecedented, it isn't really true. In 19 and part of 1920, a period of 17 months, the price index went up by 35%, which is equivalent to 25% a year. And it was this that made the government and the employers and bankers generally say, look, we've got to stop this, and they stopped it. One other thing I want to remind you of is that Marx's view is based on currency, that is, notes and coin, not on what is now somewhat vaguely called money supply. I think the Bank of England doesn't even call it money supply, they call it money stock. But they produce two indexes, M1 and M3, relating to money supply, but these are not mainly or even predominantly related to currency. Currency is included in M1, it's currency plus money on current account in the banks, after some deduction of amounts in transit, and it boils down to this, that only about 36% of M1 is in fact currency. And if you take M3, which includes money in deposit account as well, only 13.5% of M3 is currency. So that if you look at M1 and M3, you're not dealing with a currency theory like Marx, you're dealing essentially with a bank deposit theory, which is a very different sort of thing, and which Marx would not have supported in any circumstances. It would have been quite alien to Marx's view of this situation. I've also, as a matter of interest, got out a little table which you could do for yourself. I've put side by side the movements of the retail prices between 1962 and May 1974, alongside the amount of currency estimated to be in circulation in each of those years. And I'll jump from beginning to end because, for a reason I'll tell you. Retail prices jumped from 100 in 1962 to 203 in 1974. That's a rise of 103%. The currency in circulation jumped from 100 to 207. That's a rise of 107%. Well, on the face of it, this would look a very close correspondence, but I would not suggest that it really is as close as this. In the meantime, you get them deviating from each other, not very much, but there is a good reason for this, and I wouldn't suggest for a moment that you merely have to look at the figures of currency in circulation each month and expect this to tally exactly with the retail price level. There are very good reasons, and I would suggest that some of you, if you want to look at the reasons, I don't think it's ever been done better, go back and look at what Professor Cannon, who used to be a name that meant something in the London School of Economics, and I now gather it's completely forgotten. Look what Cannon wrote about it in his books on currency 30 or 40 years ago. Cannon pointed out, for example, that when inflation begins, nobody notices it. So for a long time, it has hardly any effect. On the other hand, after it's been going on for a long time, when everybody expects it to go on, you now get a different sort of time lag. You now get the prices jumping ahead of the currency, as it were. As I say, you could do quite well to look up what Cannon had to say about this. One other thing that is worth noticing about Marx, and it's peculiar to Marx, you know the kind of argument which goes, prices go up because wages go up. Well, you see, Marx pointed out that wages are prices. So if, as Marx said, wages are prices, your theory would now have to be stated in the form that some prices go up because other prices go up, which isn't going to get you very far. Now, Marx held that wages are prices because what the worker sells to the employer is what Marx called his labour power, his mental and physical energy, which is a commodity much like all the other commodities, like pedal cycles and gold and cotton and all the rest of it. The worker is selling a commodity to the employer. It is what he gets for it, his wages, therefore a price, like the price of bread and coal and all the rest of it. But wages are prices, and therefore you should look at the thing in this sort of way. If, for example, prices go up because of the depreciation of currency, well, you ought not to be surprised if one lot of prices go up and all the other prices go up. In other words, if prices generally move in much the same direction at much the same rate. Now, I want to go right away from this and point out another aspect that Marx dealt with in the monetary field, and that was Marx's view of interest rates. And I mentioned this in particular, I mentioned at the beginning that Keynes preferred Silvio Gazzell to Marx. Now, Gazzell, who had been influenced by Proudhon, who put these views forward early, and Marx dealt with Proudhon on the subject, Gazzell had a theory that by certain things you could do, the government itself could control the rate of interest and could reduce it all to vanishing point. Proudhon held the same sort of view. And when Keynes said, you know, that you can get more from Gazzell than from Marx, he was thinking of this in particular. Now, Marx took precisely the opposite view. Marx said there are no laws of interest, so to speak. Where Marx was dealing with prices of other commodities in the market, he would say that the price fluctuates round a natural price which is related to value. But with regard to interest, Marx says there are no laws, that supply and demand is the only factor that determines interest rates, that the rate of interest at any time is simply the rate which results from the offers some people are making to lend money and the demand other people are making to borrow money, that it is a result of supply and demand and nothing else. When he looked at what actually happened, he said that, generally speaking, there is a low rate of interest corresponds to periods of prosperity, a rise of interest to the transition from prosperity to its reverse, and a maximum of interest in the period of crises. But he also noted that sometimes low interest is found in periods of stagnation and moderately rising interest at a time of increasing activity. For anybody who wants to read about this, it's in Capital, Volume 3, Chapter 22. And I mention this because, you can use your own judgment, you can look at the behavior of interest rates. Notice particularly that back during the Labour government of 1964 to 70, and to some extent in the following Conservative government, you had people, you may remember Lord George Brown was associated with this, saying that the government intended to get interest rates down, and he was even rash enough to think of a figure of 3%. Well, anybody looking at it from the Marxist point of view would say this is nonsense, governments can't control interest rates, and duly, of course, that government and the government before it and the government afterwards completely failed to control interest rates. And I would say that the evidence of what actually goes on suggests that Marx was right. One other aspect, and I'm coming to the close now, Marx held a view on crises, and strictly speaking you would say, well, this is outside the monetary field, but I have to mention it because it has two particular points in it that are strictly monetary ones and very much in the public eye. Marx held, and I'll give you another quotation, "The life of modern industry becomes a series of periods of moderate activity, prosperity, overproduction, crisis, and stagnation." And he went on also to say that you had a pattern of decennial cycles with fluctuations in the middle of the cycle and things like this. Well, there's nothing particularly sacred about 10-year cycles of this, although there was a lot of material available during the middle of the 19th century, I think Jevons collected it, to show that it had averaged out for a very long time at about 10 years. But as I say, don't pay too much attention to this particular aspect of it. But where the two points I want to deal with are concerned with, the first one is this. You know the people who hold that you don't need to have this cycle. The Keynesians argued that you could iron it out and get practically no upsets, only very, very minor ones. And a lot of people have argued that you could do this by a credit policy, that given a relaxed credit policy, willingness to lend and so on, you can both avoid these things, and if they happen, you can cure them. Now, Marx completely opposed this view. Marx wrote, "The superficiality of political economy shows itself in the fact that it looks upon the expansion and contraction of credit, which is a mere symptom of the periodic changes of the industrial cycle, as their cause." In other words, Marx completely rejected this idea that, so to speak, a government or the banks can intervene in the trade cycle and effectively control it. And I would cast your memory back now as an evidence of the validity of Marx's view. When Barber was Chancellor of the Exchequer and Heath was Prime Minister, a period went on, it lasted for about 18 months, when they were constantly, both of them, appealing to captains of industry to invest more and expand production and so on, and saying to them all the time, look, we'll back you up, there's plenty of money available, we'll give you tax concessions, and the banks have got plenty of money, the banks are only too willing to lend it to you. And Barber complained that they weren't taking any notice. On one occasion he used the phrase that nobody appears to be listening. They simply didn't do it. Now Marx wouldn't have been at all surprised about this. And now a similar one, Healy, it was reported in the Times on the 5th of this month, Healy says that his 7 months as Chancellor had taught him something. And I quote, "There is no chance of investment if business expects a general and prolonged recession, however generous the tax concessions." In other words, here's Healy saying, you know, government has done a lot to encourage you to invest and you won't do it. Now, why this should surprise Healy, I don't know. It wouldn't have surprised Marx. And I doubt if it would have surprised any industrialist, either in the 19th century or now. If he thinks that there's going to be a prolonged depression ahead, he is not going to expand his production. Now, as I say, this is Marx's view, but there are a lot of people now who don't know it, and you can have them being surprised to be retaught the things that Marx and most of the capitalists knew 100 years ago. Now, the second point is this. There is a sort of bowdlerized version of Marx, which is that because Marx emphasized the class nature of society, and the fact that you had the working class dependent on wages and the capitalist dependent on profits, that that you had this class division between property owners and profit receivers and wage earners and salary earners and so on. And there is a bowdlerized version which the trade unions took up. I've even seen some trade unions actually circularizing their members on this line, a belief that because of this, a crisis could be avoided if only wages were higher. And if you get into a crisis, that a crisis could be cured by putting out wages. Well, I only want to draw your attention to the fact this is not Marx's view, it's not true, and it's not Marx's view. Marx had the same thing put to him in his lifetime, and he laughed at the idea and said, of course, this isn't true. And he pointed out that, in fact, if it were true, you would never have a crisis, because as a fact, in the period leading up to a boom, the wages of the workers always do increase faster than the production of consumer goods because of the nature of capitalism and the nature of crises. Now, I merely want to draw your attention to this to, as it were, correct the record for Marx. Marx didn't hold this simple and quite incorrect view. In conclusion, I emphasize that Marx had a monetary theory, or monetary theories, and very specific ones. And I would say that, in spite of what Keynes said about their non-applicability, they have a very lot of relevance to the present state of the economy in this and other countries, where, as you know, Germany, France, Italy, America, all of them now dealing with this threatened return of a really serious crisis, which, again, if I may cast your memory back, when the Keynesians came along and pushed Marx off the field, they were arguing that there would never be any more crises like that, and that was their major case for holding that Marx was wrong. I would again remind you that, as I said at the beginning, Marx was not saying that if you read what I have read about capitalism in my book called Capital, that you will be able to control and manage the capitalist system. It wasn't Marx who said this. This was the people who pushed Marx aside. This was the Keynesians who thought of this. What Marx was saying was that if you read Capital, you will understand how capitalism operates. But he would then say, the choice is still yours. If you look at how capitalism operates, and I would say Marx in economics does really show you how capitalism operates, you can then decide yourself. You can say, well, let's finish with it, which of course was Marx's view, and let's get rid of it, have something else. Or you could say, whatever its hardships and class conflict in it, we're going to keep it, as some people looked at it and did say. But what you can't do, so you can't take a third choice and say that by understanding capitalism, through reading what Marx wrote about it, that you can now ameliorate it and humanize it and make it into something quite different. If you think this, I mean, there's nothing to prevent you thinking it, but you cannot say that this is what Marx was telling you. Marx was telling you that capitalism cannot be controlled, it's incurable, that its crises are in the nature of capitalism, not something gone wrong, that capitalism works in this sort of way, and incidentally, that capitalism needs unemployment. Before. And this induced Kautsky to write his book called, I think, The Cost of Living, or The High Cost of Living, something like this, in which he used the Marxian method to show that the more or less worldwide rise in prices that was going on then was the other side of the fact that gold was becoming of less value. And this is how it operates. As gold becomes of less value, we owned a new technical method, it had the effect of generally raising the price level in all the industrialized countries round about the turn of the century. And if you could get hold of Kowski on the high cost of living, I think it was, you'll find this set out with a certain amount of information about the actual technical changes that were taking place. I would only add, coming back to my original point where you're dealing with political conditions, and you're dealing with a situation where all over the world people are depreciating currency, you've then got the other factor which Marx dealt with: people will be hoarding gold. And of course, if you get frightened people getting rid of paper in order to hoard gold, they will pay all sorts of prices for it. I've no doubt the, what is it, £66 an ounce of gold in the bullion market in London now is partly the consequence of this panic buying, and that if currencies were stabilised again, it would probably come down. But just one last point, there nevertheless is a comparative stability about the value of gold. It doesn't change quickly and very, very much. I mean, if something happened and it did, of course, people would have to find some other money commodity, gold, as they indeed would.
May I take a supplementary one on that, and then we'll perhaps hear gold and something else. As far as I understand it, the Marxian theory is that gold or money is valuable as for its transaction motives, using Keynes's transaction speculative precaution, but that the amount of gold that is required to service the real goods in circulation is sort of fairly fixed from a transactions point of view. Given that our economies are expanding and there are more real goods available, how do we expand the volume of gold available to keep the price constant, to keep to service the machine, as it were? Or does Marx think that the velocity of circulation changes to keep, you know, to equalize the amount of gold that the transactions demand?
Well, no. I mean, Marx would recognise, as everybody else, that the velocity of circulation changes in the cycle, but that isn't really the point. And it may be, some people have argued, of course, that there has been a long-term change in velocity of circulation, which, if it were true, if it increased, the need for currency of any kind would be diminished.
Yes.
But as regards gold, you see, you are not... In carrying on the transaction, buying and selling transactions, never at any time did you in fact have to have this all done by gold. See, in the 19th century you had Bank of England notes. And if you use Bank of England notes, which are as good as gold because they're convertible, you are diminishing the need to have actual gold there. You don't have to. So to speak, if transactions went on growing, and you say the supply of gold doesn't increase with it, it doesn't matter. I mean, because you could do without gold altogether.
Provided confidence remains.
Well, yeah, provided you restrict the issue of the notes. You see, if you keep the issue of the notes restricted, you needn't have the gold there at all. In short, you see, while in the 19th century, because everybody all over the world knew that the Bank of England note was as good as gold, they didn't, in fact, go to the Bank of England and say, give us gold. They were content to take the note. So the amount of gold the Bank of England actually needed was comparatively small. And it could have been made smaller. There never was enough gold in the Bank of England to meet all the demands that could have been made on it if everybody had gone along with notes and said, we want gold. But as you say, they had confidence in it. And they had confidence in it because the issue was restricted. See, if you know that the government is going to restrict the issue of notes, you begin to restore your confidence in notes. The reason why people don't want to hold paper currency is because they're afraid it's depreciating, as happened to extreme in Germany in 1923, and of course it's happening here. People now are buying anything rather than hold notes. Well, it gets to the extreme point. I was in Germany in 1923, where nobody would take notes at all. If you were a worker, you said to your employer, no, I don't want your money. Give me food, give me clothes, give me anything. Or give me dollars or pounds, don't give me marks. But in other words, Marx used that phrase in that passage I quoted, where Marx said there comes a time, of course, where the confidence in the money disappears. And then, of course, you're in trouble. You've got to do something else.
Thank you.
Yeah. Any other points?
How did Marx account for the transfer? Did he just take it as given?
Well, no. Marx held that capitalism was evil because the possibility of the workers being more or less fully employed, something approaching this, depends on the capitalism constantly expanding. In other words, let me approach it from another point of view. Suppose, merely as a sort of figure, though it's, I'll take one that's more or less true, suppose output per worker on average was increasing at the rate of 3% a year. Well, if total sales of goods, production and sales of goods goes up by 3% a year, then you've got a state of equilibrium. In other words, workers can go on being employed, those of them who are employed. So that what goes wrong with capitalism from time to time is that, as Marx would say, you get all kinds of disproportions and disequilibria coming into it. Suppose, for example, take the sort of case you're familiar with, suppose you get, as you have had, periodically, a lot of countries increase their steel mills. As you know, in recent years, the Japs have been forging ahead, overtaking Russia and America. And suppose they don't work in with each other. The Japs don't say, look, we won't build any more steel mills because the Americans and the Russians have got some. They're all doing it. And there comes a time when they've all got their steel mills going and there's too much steel in the world. I mean, this happens periodically and quite drastically. Everybody knows it. The steel board knows this, you see. And then there's too much steel in the world, the demand drops, and the steel mills start cutting down production. In an extreme case, they start standing workers off or closing down mills. Well, when you get this happening, you see that you get a major disequilibrium with capitalism. You get the same sort of thing, of course, with the motor industry. Ever since the war, in spite of all the belief that they had managed it, you get periods when there's an unlimited demand for motor cars everywhere, and they're all expanding plant and producing cars. Suddenly they find that they produce too much for the demand of the market at that time, and they start cutting back. I mean, at times there have been tens of thousands of motor workers in this country and other countries all stood off at the same time. But when this happens, they're no longer getting wages, the capitalist is no longer going in the market trying to buy materials again to expand production, and you get the reverse process taking place. And I mean, this is Marx's explanation. Marx said that whatever the reason for the periodicity of it, which in spite of his assumption that it was 10 years, he didn't really think, you know, that you could forecast it like this. There is a periodicity that you do get overproduction for the market, and when this happens, you get a setback, and the setback can become cumulative downwards. It can spiral downwards, so to speak. Like the very long depression, 1870 to 1890, and that between the wars. But if I can put my hands on the passage where Marx, if you wanted to read it up, it's Marx summarized his views in Capital, Volume 3, in the co-edition, it's page 568. He says, if you set aside price changes and speculations, and assuming for simplification that society is composed of industrial capitalists only, which is of course a broad assumption, what Marx is really saying, there are all sorts of things can upset it. I mean, a war, a famine, a bankruptcy of a big firm can upset the equilibrium. But setting these aside, he said, in that case, a crisis could be explained only by a disproportion of production in various branches and by a disproportion of the consumption of the capitalists and the accumulation of their capitals. But as matters stand, the reproduction of their capitals invested in production depends largely upon the consuming power of the non-producing classes, while the consuming power of the labourers is handicapped partly by the laws of wages, partly by the fact that it can be exerted only so long as the labourers can be employed at a profit for the capitalist class. The last cause of all real crises always remains the poverty and restricted consumption of the masses as compared to the tendency of capitalist production to develop the productive forces in such a way that only the absolute consumption of the entire society would be their limit. Well, you see, once capitalism starts going into disequilibrium, you no longer have all the the members of society, workers in capitalism, everybody else, consuming the limit. They're not. I mean, the workers can't buy, and as soon as capitalists start cutting back, their profits are cut and they can't buy. Just one warning about this. Marx, you've got to distinguish between what, so to speak, is the activating cause of a crisis and the final condition for a crisis. See, Marx says, behind everything is the fact that you've got a class society where workers can only get wages, and where the capitalists are dependent on profit, and the thing only, you only get, so to speak, relative prosperity, provided it's going on expanding. And there may seem to be a contradiction between those two statements, but as I say, you have to recognize the difference in the condition and the activating cause. It's like saying, it's not a precise analogy, but it may serve, if you've got explosive gas in a coal mine, you can say this, in the last resort, is the cause of explosions in a coal mine. But of course, this can go on for years and you have no explosion. But if you get a spark off some electrical coal cutting machine and it blows out, you can then say the activating cause of the explosion is the spark. Well, you've got the similar sort of situation with chemicals.
Surely one of the reasons why
Marx
said in 1931 was the consequences of unemployment. So,
yeah,
that's a
distant bad
point as well.
Well, remember what I pointed out, that all through the 19th century, the capitalists managed without depreciating the currency. They had crises, they had depressions, they had always some unemployment. Sometimes it was very high, and it was a political problem to them, very much a political problem to them. And you've got the same now, but you see what has happened. The British capitalist class in 1931, having had a government elected with the priority for saving the pound, they decided to let the pound go and to get off the gold standard, which meant, in effect, depreciating the currency. They did this for political reasons. I mean, they at that time, well, they had a couple of million unemployed, and they had been persuaded by some of their advisers that their troubles were really due to having gone back to the gold standard. But of course, this is, this has to be proved, but I'd say it's incapable of proof, but it isn't true. That whether you're on the gold standard, as in the 19th century, or whether you go off it, you're going to get the same sort of consequences. This will be Marx's view. And let me remind you, all the people who said, and I mean, I know, between the wars on the platform and after the war, we were being told by all sorts of people, look, Marx is out of date, there's never going to be any crisis anymore. Well, I hardly need to emphasize the fact that you've got it all over the world, in spite of the fact that they have not gone back to the gold standard and they have not restricted the note issue.
But that's not to say if you did that
would
solve problems by your
argument. Oh, no, my argument is it wouldn't solve anything. No, don't get me wrong. Marx wasn't saying, you know, if you do what I say, you'll have a lovely capitalism. Marx was saying, capitalism will be just what it is, whatever you do. But he was saying to them, in fact, if you depreciate the currency, you'll have rising prices. He didn't say if you get rid of it. On the contrary, in 1920, when they restricted the note issue, they did solve the problem of inflation, and you had 2.5 million unemployed. And in 1926, you had the general strike. Oh, they weren't sold anything. Don't get Marx wrong. See, you've got to remember, all these other economists are in the field of saying to the government, look, you do what we say, and everything will be all right. Marx is right out of this business. Marx is in the field of saying, you do whatever you like. Capitalism will still be a system which cannot be justified for the working class, or cannot be justified now for society. It's time to get rid of it.
I've got a technical question. Prices used in